Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Top 100 Project with Ryan and Bev Ellis. If you're a new listener, we invite you to check out our introductory podcast in which we discuss the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the greatest American films of all time. Before you go any further, be warned. What you're about to hear is riddled with spoilers. We suggest you watch the movie before listening to this podcast.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Bonjour, movie fans. It's Ryan and Bev again. So, we're going to start this podcast with the coming attractions trivia for this week's movie, Casablanca. The question last week was, Casablanca takes place in Morocco, which makes it the first AFI movie to be set entirely in Africa. What, Bev, is the next AFI picture to be set on the Dark Continent?
It's right in the title.
Mm-hmm.
What year did it come out?
1951.
1951? The African Queen.
Also starring Bogart.
Yep, and Katharine Hepburn.
Mm-hmm. So we'll review that one early next year. All right, so the Top 100 Project's 31st movie is the beloved Casablanca. It was number two on AFI's 1998 Top 100 list between Citizen Kane and The Godfather. Lofty, lofty company. But fell down one spot to number three in 2007 between The Godfather again and Raging Bull. The film premiered in New York City on November 26, 1942, and is thought of as a 1942 film. But Warner Brothers gave the movie a full release on January 23rd, 1943. It was successful, but certainly wasn't a big hit. Bev has the skinny on this film.
World War II era American bar owner Rick Blaine, played by Humphrey Bogart, finds a former flame named Ilse Lund, played by Ingrid Bergman, walking into his Moroccan gin joint with her freedom-fighting husband Victor Laszlo, played by Paul Henreid. Laszlo is a key member of the resistance against the Nazis, who got a stronghold in Northern Africa. Cynical Rick struggles with his conscience about whether or not to get involved, while also falling for Ilse all over again.
In a nutshell, bar owner and cop casually walk away from murder scene.
Which they do.
And start their love affair.
Your beautiful friendship.
All right, this is one of the most famous movies that's ever been made. As was Citizen Kane, as was Gone with the Wind. But this is really, truly a beloved classic. What did you think of it?
Well, I love it. This is a great movie. It's just so much fun to watch. In the summer before I went to film school, I made this point of watching all these old classic films I'd never seen. And this was one of them. And it was probably one of the oldest films I saw, and I was 19 years old and probably pretty cynical about old movies. I hadn't seen a ton of them, and it really won me over. It was, I think I said this about Citizen Kane as well, it was an old movie that opened my eyes to what I'd been missing and why people loved all these classic old films, and stopped me from associating old films with kind of
homework.
Homework. Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
Hard vegetable soup.
Hard vegetable soup.
In joke from the third podcast. The third podcast, The Gold Rush. Anyway, continue.
It's such an engaging movie. The script is just whip smart. And
a script that was being written as they were making the movie.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. I mean, it was based on a play. Well, a play that never got made, but it was based on some existing material, but they certainly...
But they were still writing, though, during the production.
And they had screenwriters come and go as well. Mm-hmm. They started out with the Epstein twins.
Yeah, Philip and Julius Epstein.
Mm-hmm.
Who we mentioned last week for Yankee Doodle Dandy, they'd had some writing credit on that. Uncredited, they did some work for Michael Curtiz, the director of both of these films, two in a row for him.
But then while they were working on the script, Pearl Harbor was attacked, and they left the project to go work with Frank Capra on Why We Fight.
Yeah, the Why We Fight series.
Yeah, yeah.
That documentary that was made several years ago was named Why We Fight in reference to the series that was made during World War II.
So, but while I love this movie, I really do, I think if I was going to make a personal top 10 of movies of all time, I don't think I would put it in the top 10, let alone number 2.
You know one thing I have in my awards notes section of this is that Casablanca never once made the top 10 list of the recently discussed Sight and Sound poll.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
All the years they did, never once in the top 10.
Because it doesn't do what Sight and Sound rewards. Like, Casablanca's greatest strength is also, in a way, its greatest weakness. It's a perfect studio film. Everything that they learned, like a culmination of all the techniques that they perfected, from lighting to sets to casting, certainly,
casting,
you know,
was key with this
the
movie.
The cast is phenomenal. They figured out all these things and they did it well, but they also were kind of relying on all the same kind of tired old stereotypes and tropes and expectations that the audience had. It's just an easy film to like. There's really not very much that's challenging about it, and the Sight and Sound list rewards challenging and innovative films, which it's not. But it's just, it's a Hollywood film that nails being a Hollywood film, which is that it's just an absolute pleasure to watch.
In a much more impressive way, it's as patriotic as our previous film, Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Yes, yeah, but which, with way more nuance and in a way, authentic love for your people, for your country. It strikes a way more
real... because it's a very international cast.
Yeah, but everybody has this kind of loyalty to their people. They have loyalty to each other. They're kind of in this together, but there is this, what's best about nationalism is a little bit expressed in this film because, particularly if you're French, I think, but in a little bit of a way American, because you have Rick and Sam who are Americans who miss America, and you get the impression that whatever is keeping him from going home is kind of a tragedy to him, that he misses his home.
We never do find out why he can't just go back.
No,
or why he doesn't just go back.
It's a mystery that remains.
I like the line he has where the movie takes place before the Pearl Harbor attack. That's it, set before Pearl Harbor. And that probably partly explains why Bogart has the line that I like so much, which is, they're asleep all across America. Because they're like metaphorically asleep. They're not really awakened to the fact that what's going on in the world. Take a stand, America. And America was being accused by many other countries of not doing anything about it until the chip was knocked off their shoulder and they just did something about it. Let's not indict America for the way they handled themselves getting into World War II. But it's a smart line by an American who's almost lamenting about the fact that I've witnessed this now, because he was in Paris. Well, always at Paris. Well, he witnessed when things started going bad there, flees to Africa and finds out things are even worse and his countrymen are not doing anything about it yet. But yeah, the movie is extremely patriotic in the grand tradition of Michael Bay's Pearl Harbor. A love triangle set against the backdrop of World War II.
Yeah. Part of the plot is probably hard to follow because some of the nuances of this... it's important to remember when you're watching this movie that when it was being made and when it was released, they were in the middle of World War II. Like, they were rushing the release because they wanted to stay on top of events so that the film will still have some kind of current gravity with the people who are watching it. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily factually accurate in terms of people did not get to America via Africa back then, but it was accurate in the way that France was actually still occupied when the movie was made. There actually was a German military presence in French Africa as
French
well.
French Morocco, sure.
In a way, it makes it harder to follow because some of the nuance of the French freedom fighting, you know, didn't trickle its way down to my history class. I don't know about you, but I didn't know what Vichy was until I was looking it up after seeing this movie.
I don't know much about Vichy, but at the very end of the movie, when Louis finally truly sides with Rick, one of the many famous lines, round up the usual suspects, he throws away the bottle of Vichy water. And it's almost like he's finally taking a stand. He's been playing one side against the other the whole time. Louis is corrupt, but he's not a bad person. He doesn't seem to be.
Yeah.
A bad person. He is instrumental in Ugarte, the Peter Lorre character, getting killed. Mm-hmm. But then Ugarte murdered somebody and stole their papers, though, too. It's not like he's some innocent person.
He's also coercing sex acts out of people in exchange for visas.
So Louis's not exactly the
the
most wonderful person in the history of Morocco or Casablanca.
Yeah.
But he doesn't seem to be a horrible person. And he's enabled Rick to do these things for all kinds of reasons, to have this nightclub and to do some of the things.
And
he
like
does.
Rick, who's kind of ambiguous himself, who did something terrible to get his butt kicked out of America, and who doesn't stick his neck up for nobody, as he repeatedly says.
I have a trivia question for that.
Oh, okay. Hit me.
So how many times does Rick say, "I stick my neck out for nobody"? Before he actually sticks his neck out for somebody at the end of the film.
I think he says it exactly like that twice, but then he says something like some version of that later on in like the third act of
the
film.
So yeah, three times he says it.
Either
those words or that's what he's saying.
All right.
Yeah. Either literally those words or close enough.
Yeah.
That actually reminds me a lot of Unforgiven. There's a recurring line in Unforgiven where Eastwood or Morgan Freeman continually say, "You ain't like that no more," about his murderous past.
Yeah.
"I ain't like that no more." When you're watching Unforgiven, I wonder if he's going to become like that again. I like Unforgiven. I've grown to like the movie a lot more than when I first saw it. But I remember saying that to somebody after I'd seen the movie, that what I just said to you, which is, they beat it to death.
Yeah. I mean, Unforgiven is a great Hollywood film. These are movies that, like I said, Casablanca's strength is also its weakness. It's a great Hollywood film, but the weakness with that is it doesn't give its audience a ton of credit. Like, I was thinking about the script and about how it's kind of guilty of doing things that are a little bit condescending and not realistic. It says over and over, I don't stick my neck out for nobody. They are constantly repeating the exposition to make sure that everybody has a handle on it. They see people's names over and over. Like, how many times do you hear Rick, Victor, Laszlo? How many times do you hear the words Victor, Laszlo when you're... And it's all to kind of help the audience keep everything straight, because it's a kind of convoluted
plot.
But
when it comes to the plot, isn't that necessary?
It is necessary.
Maybe not their characters' names, but the plot.
Yeah, and I find it frustrating when people, you know, I have tried several times to get into The Wire, but I just find it so confusing.
They maybe don't give you enough credit. Sorry, they give you too much credit.
I think that's it, and it's so frustrating for me, and you combine that with the fact that I just kind of have crummy hearing, and they use so much slang, and I can't follow what's going on from scene to scene, and I find it frustrating, and it's just too much work for me in the end. And I've gotten plenty of hard time about that over the years.
I think Mad Men is also like that too. The TV show.
Oh, see, Mad Men, it doesn't bother me. Maybe it's because I can hear and make out everything they're saying.
Well, I've not gotten into that show as much as other people have. I think part of it is because I have a hard time sometimes following who is who. Now, they're all underlings of that company,
mm-hmm.
but I think that's part of it. And maybe the show, like The Wire,
yeah.
almost expects you to follow too much. Like, you're supposed to watch these TV shows every week.
Yeah.
And how are you supposed to necessarily remember every little detail every week? We're watching on
and
Netflix.
The Sopranos was guilty of that, too, as I recall. Mm-hmm. They would just name a character once and then bring them up 6 months later, and you're supposed to remember who they were.
But versus network shows where they tell you, like you say, in Casablanca, mm-hmm. Victor Laszlo, Victor Laszlo, Victor Laszlo.
There's tons. The exposition is just over and over and over again. Even though they leave some things just straight up mysterious, the stuff that's important for the plot, they repeat. How often do they tell you how important the letters of transit are?
The letters of transit. That's something, the more I see this movie and I've read some things about it, I know you have too, that is definitely mockable. Because it is a made-up device, and the writers admit it was a made-up device. They're not denying that for a second. And it's one of the examples of yet another MacGuffin, which we've talked about plenty, and we're going to talk about this even more when we get to the Hitchcock movies, where there's the director who coined that phrase. But there's such a ridiculous device if you really give it some thought, which is like the whole thing with Laszlo getting the letters is so important. At the very end of the movie, he does, and that's how he gets himself and Ilsa out, spoiler alert. And yet he's supposed to be such a key member of the resistance against them. The Nazis weren't polite Marcus of Queensberry rules following people.
No.
Oh, he's got papers. Well, then okay, let him go. But they would
there
blow his head
nothing.
Off.
There was nothing stopping the Nazis.
They
like,
would assassinate him in a second if they
like,
saw him.
They
he was
Peter.
In a concentration camp and got away. He's a wanted man at this point.
Like, Peter Lorre's character is presumably killed for no reason other than he's a petty thief that they just want to get rid of. There is no... Why wouldn't they have just arrested him on site? They absolutely mm-hmm. would have. There's no way they would have just let him run around Casablanca.
Or like, as the Nazis were known to do, blow his head off.
Yeah, exactly. They don't need letters of transit to arrest Victor Laszlo yet. That concept that he's walking around free is so strange. Like, you really do struggle with it. And the letters of transit, which I was having this conversation with a friend of mine this week, and he pointed out, they never even use the letters of transit. They never actually, you never see them present those letters to anybody and actually use them in the way that they're meant to be used.
Somebody in the plane maybe had to see them then.
I don't know. Have you ever, like, had somebody check your ID once you're already on a plane?
They check your passport a lot when you go through an airport. I don't know.
I guess so, but not once you're on the plane. Once you're on the plane, they just... They
finally believe you. You belong here.
And, okay, I guess maybe airport security is different now than it was during wartime in the 40s, and I'm willing to believe that, but it just seems like the authorities that they should have had to present those papers to not only didn't check them, but were ultimately murdered by Renault at the end of the film. So the letters of transit became such a non-issue that it is kind of this silly thing that they were fighting over. And they could have just, he could have just kept the letters and kept them for himself. After all was said and done, put them on the plane, hang on to those letters of transit, go anywhere he wants to go, or sell them for a fortune now that he's sold his bar.
Yeah, he's got no more roots tying him to Casablanca.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he and Louis are going to go off to Brazzaville, I believe is what Louis says.
Which was the name of the unproduced sequel that the studio went into pre-production for, but never actually got it off the ground.
One of those movies that didn't have a sequel, any official sequels at least. It's been remade a few times, and there's been adaptations.
And TV shows.
And we'll get to that at the end here. But yeah, no sequel itself, and that's probably a smart thing to do. There'd be some interesting stories to tell. I mean, what happened with Laszlo
Rick
and Ilsa? What happened with Rick and Louis?
Rick as a character is totally... You could have definitely had more adventures with him. I think he could have been a really interesting character to follow. Like, he kind of reminds me of John McClane in a way that, as much as Die Hard is this great singular story, there's no harm in just carrying on and seeing where he goes next and what he does next.
There might be. There's some movies that probably should never have been sequelized or remade, and this is one of them. I think just leave it alone. Just
like
don't make a color. And
I'm saying, like, if in the 50s they had made a sequel.
That was not what they did back then. There were sequels back then.
Yeah, that's true.
There are not very many sequels on the FI list, and there are very few, in fact. There are not even very many movies that were sequelized. Remade, yes. Frankenstein and many others were remade. All right, let's change things up a little bit. We always save this for the end. I'm going to do it right now. The awards and other AFI lists, because I think this is the most honored AFI film in the history of the top 100s. So here's the list. First of all, it won the 3 Oscars for Best Picture, Best Director, Michael Curtiz, Best Screenplay for The Epsteins and Howard Koch. It also was nominated for 5 others, including for Bogart, lead actor Humphrey Bogart, and Claude Rains. No surprise, National Film Registry, 1989. Here is the list, though, that is AFI aplenty. Casablanca was 37th on the top 100 Thrills, 32nd on the top 100 Cheers. Rick was the 4th best White Hat on the Heroes and Villains list. It was number 2 on the top 100 Songs with As Time Goes By, and number 1 on the top 100 Passions list. I remember when I saw that show, I called that before it even started that night.
Yeah.
No surprise there. And this is maybe the most impressive of all, which doesn't surprise me, because when I saw this movie for the first time, I thought, I know that quote, and that one, and that one, and that one. Well, it had 6 of them on the top 100 quotes list.
The next runner-up is a tie for 2nd between Gone with the Wind and
Wizard of Oz,
yeah. And they each had 3. Like, nobody even came close to touching it. And I think that that's an important distinction, because as wonderful as the stars are, as competent as the directing is, and there's all kinds of things that are about it that are wonderful, but the real star, the real thing that makes it above and beyond excellent, is the script.
Yeah, that's true. So here are the 6. So 67th was, of all the gin joints in all the towns and all the wild, she walks into mine. 43rd was, well, always at Paris. 32 was, round up the usual suspects. 28th was, play it, Sam. Play as time goes by. 20th was, Louis, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. And 5th was, here's looking at you, kid. And that doesn't even include the line that we like so much, and maybe my favorite line in the movie. I'm shocked, to find illegal gambling here. You're winning, sir. Oh, thank you.
That quote requires setup, but it's like one of the best little comic moments in the movie, and certainly
it's
one of the best
as,
of that Claude Rains delivers.
It's as funny as anything in any comedy we've watched.
Oh, yeah.
Like, so far. It's hilarious.
Cracks me up.
Claude
so
Rains
funny.
Steals the whole movie. He's brilliant in this
one. Yeah, I love him.
He's extremely funny, and he's extremely great. He's in another AFI film yet to come, and I want to double back from it to the beginning of the film to say something that I noticed that will affect you, because you once lived in this area, and that is the map at the beginning of the movie shows Arabia.
I noticed that.
The various countries that are there.
Yeah,
obviously, Iraq takes up a big part of that, and Saudi Arabia takes up a big part of that, but it just says this big Arabia. But that's a nice setup to Lawrence of Arabia, which will be covered by us next summer on this list, and that's also the next and last time we will see Claude Rains. But you once lived in Saudi Arabia with your family.
I'm trying to remember, like, I know I studied Arabian history while I lived there, but I also lived there when I was a little kid, and I don't remember if that whole peninsula was just Arabia, but I doubt it. I don't think all those different countries, they I'm sure the map wouldn't have looked the same in the 40s as it looks now, but I'm also pretty sure that it wasn't just Arabia. But it was kind of the 40s. Like, people didn't travel back then. It was just Arabia. They weren't really aware, nor did they care all that much about the nuance of territories, of lands that they weren't familiar with.
That sort of brings us into a trivia question, so I'll do number 2. Where is everyone waiting to get to when they're in Casablanca? What city?
I know this. It is the capital of Portugal. Lisbon.
Lisbon it is.
Yeah, that's their... They go to Lisbon, and then they get the boat to America. Because Portugal was neutral in the war.
That's during the open narration we discover that. And that's also another good line in the movies in the narration. No one ever talks about this. The line where the guy says, they go to Casablanca, and wait, and wait, and wait, and wait.
It's great script.
Obviously implies a lot of people just stay there and probably die. Either of old age or violence or...
Run out of money near the beginning of the film. Rick, you know, laughs at somebody who's in charge of the second biggest bank in the Netherlands. And he laughs because, well, the leader of the first biggest bank in the Netherlands is my cook right now. You know, you just eventually run out of money waiting, and then you get stuck there. The script is full of so many great lines, like, that they narrowed it down to 6 top ones. There's so much great back and forth banter, and yeah. it's wonderful to have it in the hands of these really great actors. There just isn't a slouch in the cast. Everybody's wonderful.
That's why I wanted to do the AFI lists and the Oscars and everything closed up front, more in the middle of the podcast, because it does talk about how it was rewarded by the Academy Awards. They knew even then it was a very good film, and it certainly has gained a reputation since. It wasn't supposed to have been a great film.
Yeah,
it was Bogart just... and Bergman didn't think they were making a very good film at the time, yeah. And I think she in particular thought it was a piece of crap. Paul Henry, I don't think he liked it even after it came out, because he felt like he was supposed to have been a star, and he's been marginalized now. He got top billing with Bogart and Bergman. He was one of the three on the mm-hmm. poster at the top. But he certainly isn't as important in this movie as I don't know, even Dooley Wilson's got a more important role than he does in an on-screen.
Even though Dooley Wilson, I think, in the cast list
gets buried.
Way yeah. down in the bottom, yeah.
One of the rare black men in the movie. But then again, a black man who's finally in an AFI movie treated with some respect.
With, lines yep, and a personality. An important
character. Yeah. He's got a fairly decent arc of his own. When he calls somebody boss, he actually is calling someone who is his boss.
Yes, yeah. But they actually seem to, they treat him like an employee, but they also seem to treat him with respect. And mm-hmm. he's a talented man, and they seem to like him like a friend. It's refreshing to finally see mm-hmm. This film is full of diversity. It's a very international cast, and it's
mostly
a very
white people, but they are very, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a diverse cast, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's refreshing to see that at all, but especially to see, it's embarrassing to even point Sam out as a big advancement in diversity, because in a film, if that film was made today, that would it would not be impressive whatsoever. Mm. It would be, in a way, a step backwards. But compared to all these other films that we've seen and the portrayal of non-white people in all the other movies that we've seen, this is definitely a step forward.
Right. I got off on a bit of a tangent there, which I've never done before. But I got a tangent about how this wasn't supposed to have been a flagship production for Warner Brothers the way it became and awarded the way it was, and how no one really had much respect for it. And that's maybe more impressive when you consider that it's on these lists. It's second and third on the AFI list, the two different years, and all the top rankings on the other lists. It wasn't really a troubled production compared to, I guess you could say, Gone with the Wind, Wizard of Oz, and many of the movies we've yet to come that were extremely troubled. But when it comes to people involved in it not really believing in it, that's kind of a factor right there, I guess. Well, okay, I mentioned a minute ago, Bogart and Bergman, that they didn't really think they were making a particularly great film, Bergman in particular. Let's talk about those two, the big stars of this film. Humphrey Bogart, his second AFI film. He's got two more great ones to come. One of them is a few weeks from now, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. And Bergman, this is her only AFI mm-hmm. appearance. The only time that one of the best actresses who's ever lived was in an AFI film. And she's so emotional in this film without weeping. She cries a few times.
She's very vulnerable. She has this great... she's not weak, but she has this really great emotional world that sits just barely below the surface.
Yeah.
She really pulls that off well.
You believe that she loves both men. You can see why she looks like... The scene that's really key for her about why she cares about Laszlo, she admires him. You can certainly mm-hmm. believe that. Anybody could admire this person. But why does she love him? Why would she ever even think about staying with him over Rick? Which, of course, at the end of the movie, she's ready to go off with Rick. Mm-hmm. she even says, I can't leave you again. So she's going to give up her husband. But still, it's not easy for her to do it. And I think the key scene is that great scene. And one of the reasons why this film made the AFI's Thrills list is the scene when they're doing the dueling anthems. One of the rare times in the history of a movie or anything where national anthems becomes a scene of suspense. The Marseillaise with the French anthem and I think it's called Watch on the Rhine, the German song, and the French, of course, drown them out. And you see people crying.
Yeah.
Some of that was legit because these people actually were, for them, it was real. They'd experienced what had already happened in
Europe. They were experiencing what was happening in
experiencing,
France.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, they were exiled from their country that they loved because of the German occupation.
Right, and it's in that scene where Bergman, they cut to a shot of her, and she's looking at him with such devotion.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe she doesn't have the same sort of passion that she does for Rick, but you can buy that she admires him more than just as a brother type. There's a real bona fide love for this guy who stands up in front of a bunch of Nazis, and as we said, a guy who probably should have been shot to death by now or put in jail by the Nazis.
Yeah.
But he's
should have been flown way more under the radar than he ever does in
But he has the courage to stand up in front of this band and say, no, what, we're going to drown out that stupid anthem.
And everybody admires him.
In a symbolic
him.
Way. It
he's
doesn't
kind
mean
of
anything.
Like a rock star in a way. Like, I can see how that's attractive to her. And he's an extremely good husband. He treats her very good. He cares about her safety. There's a point where he knows Rick's in love with her, and he knows in a way that she's in love with Rick. But he thinks, and he says to Rick, take care of her. It's, you know, she should stay with you where she's going to be safe. Like, he cares more about her being safe than having her to himself, even though he loves her so much, and that's really evident. This is one of the problems I've kind of had with the movie over the years, is that Victor Laszlo is just such a catch. Like, like, I don't really understand why it's a hard decision for her. If you're married to a man as wonderful as Victor Laszlo, why you would want to go back. And I understand, like, you had this passionate love affair with someone, but this is your husband and this is a great man. But then I thought about it, because, you know, just about the entire world disagrees with me on this point, that it's so obvious that she should stay with Rick. Maybe she doesn't want to run around the world being chased by Nazis. Maybe after a life with Laszlo, it would be nice to just settle down and run a bar with Rick in Casablanca.
Or do anything other than...
Do anything,
go with the resistance leader. He's probably not going to live
forever. Yeah, yeah. Like, as much as she belongs with Victor for many reasons, because it's the right thing for her to do, it's the right thing for Rick to do, maybe she would actually just have a calmer, happier life hanging out with Rick, if only she wouldn't have to live with the guilt of breaking the heart of this wonderful, noble man, Victor Laszlo.
Yeah. And incidentally, another quote that wasn't on the list was the, if that plane leaves the ground, you're not on it, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon, for the rest of your life, which I think is a great...
I also too. Love from the same scene, and you could probably do this better than me, but the problems of two people don't amount to a hill of beans in this world. And this was so true, especially at the time. You know, the world was experiencing this massive crisis, and it's important.
Their feelings don't matter in comparison
to
that.
Compared to
who cares about
what was
their
going on with
affair.
World War II. If the morale of this man could help turn the tide of World War II even a little bit, then yes, I'm sorry, you have to give up your passionate love affair with Rick in Casablanca, and you have to go with your husband, and you have to do the right thing.
And Rick understands that more than Ilsa does.
Yeah, because she's
Victor
just,
understands it
she's
more
too caught up in it.
Victor maybe doesn't understand it, but he would more than she does, at least.
Yeah. And it plays into the big theme of the film, which is sacrifice.
Yeah.
You know, Rick is willing to sacrifice Ilsa, and Victor is willing to sacrifice Ilsa.
I find that to be a very emotional part of the film, too. I rarely got an emotional watching this film. I love the movie, but that's something that really knocked me out this time. I was a couple times almost overcome when we saw it because of that. I think when I see a movie where a character is willing to give up something, and maybe give up everything for somebody else, it's something as I get older that I really find to be way more meaningful than the typical crying moments in a movie.
Yeah.
And it's that dry-eyed way of doing it, the way that everyone in this movie, well, of course, Ilsa cries a few times, but certainly the guys don't. And it's got to be killing Bogart to say, go off and be with this guy. This is more important than me. And for someone to do that, and because I know it's coming, the evolution of him is coming. He's given up a bar that he probably liked working with. He liked working with Sam. He liked even Sidney Greenstreet's character, the senior Ferrari. Trivia question number three. What's the name of the bar that Ferrari owns?
It's the Blue Parrot.
Yep. He even seems to have some sort of fondness for this kind of shady character that owns a rival bar.
He seems to have a fondness for his life as the curmudgeon-y bar owner,
And he does have nobility, even though he says I'm no good at being noble. By the way, I like that element of, we talked a few minutes ago about Sam being a real person for once and not being treated like he's just some...
Butt of a joke.
Because when Ferrari and Rick are talking about Ferrari buying the bar before he does buy the bar, which I guess is a day or two later, and he's not going to sell, but it's all about, well, I'll take Sam then. Well, Sam's free to go. And they're bargaining for his services. They're not bargaining for his life. It's not like, well, I'm going to buy your slave. Like we mentioned, we saw 12 Years a Slave a few weeks ago. And in that movie, two people in their same situation would have been saying, well, I'm going to buy that man from you rather than I'm going to hire him from you.
So even
Ferrari, who's a bit shady, is more like, well, if he doesn't want to work for me, then okay, I guess he stays with you.
Yeah. Before we finish talking about the ending, you know, people talk about this ending like it's just such a great surprise and such a daring thing that Ilsa should go off with Victor instead of stay with Rick, or like everybody wants her to. But I think it's because when you set a movie up this way, the audience, people are always going to choose virtue and idealism over romance.
Yep.
And that's why the ending works. And that's why it's still kind of a Hollywood ending. I mean, certainly a Hollywood ending, because there's no way the code would have allowed her to just leave her husband.
I've read that in various places over the years, that this whole thing, people have always said that Bergman played it down the middle. That was Curti's direction, because it was, who am I going to end up with? How do I know which one to play it? Well, don't tip your hand. You don't know who you're going to end up with, so to play it down the middle. And yet that's been brought up as well, that the co could not have allowed her to just walk away from her husband if he's alive and well and everything.
I think there was, I read there was a version of a script floating around where Victor Laszlo was killed.
So then she's
and
free
then
to
she ended
with
up with Rick, or at least in the writer's room when they were floating around ideas of how the film could have ended. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things that they suggested, but they did ultimately decide that to make the theme kind of much bigger and more overarching and much more about kind of human virtue.
Mm.
And an appropriate theme for wartime.
When a real war was happening.
When a real war was happening, and that was a real, real part of people's consciousness at the time.
Yeah. Yep. Well, I mentioned it was number one on the top 100 passions list. And the host of that show, at the end of it, I forget who it was now, but she said something about how, and they lived happily ever after. Well, not always. And I was thinking the same kind of line, which was, I forget what their top 10 was on the 100 passions, but many of the top 20 even mm-hmm. were not movies where people ended up together. I won't say what they are for fear of giving them away to people who might want to know. But a lot of the great love stories have been about the Romeo and Juliet kind of thing.
They're tragedies, really. Yeah.
Whether you've lost something or somebody dies or you both die.
In a way, there's something kind of enduringly romantic about that too, right? There's something really appealing about that to audiences.
And... Well, plus, in the end, Casablanca does have a happy ending because the married couple does stay together, however much longer he's going to live, fighting against the Nazis. Mm-hmm. And the real love affair, the bromance, is consummated because Renaud is clearly kind of in love with Rick.
Yeah, his redemption is just such a little jewel in this film. You're so happy when he comes around and does the right thing in a way even more than Rick. Because Rick, you see it coming a mile away, but when Renaud comes around, there's just something so delightful about that moment. When he throws out the Vichy water, as you say.
Well, even his great line, that's one of the top 100 quotes, the Round of the Usual Suspects line, is such a great line because he says it earlier in the movie in a different kind of context. When it's all about how this is none of these people, like clearly there's only two people at the airport that could have done this. It's either Renaud or Rick. And yet the various cops seem to have bought it. Okay, let's go find those guys then. They must have run away, I guess. They're nowhere near this airport. But that's such a great line because it's such a crock. This captain is going to cover this up right then and there for his friend. But he also does it in a split second. He is not on Rick's side until Rick shoots.
Yeah.
Conrad Veidt plays Strasser. Good villain, by the way. He shoots him. And even at that moment, I don't know what Renaud is thinking. But it's almost like when the other cops happen to arrive right then, it's almost like, who am I with? I'm with him.
Mm-hmm. And then he decides where his loyalty lies and he does the right thing.
Yeah. We talked about the cast. Let's finish up the other people in the cast. It's a long list. I want to say their names for fear of leaving some key ones out beyond Bogart and Bergman. We mentioned a lot of them. Sidney Greenstreet, who's now in his second AFI movie after The Maltese Falcon.
Which was his debut.
His debut. Peter Lorre, also in both of those movies. Both in kind of small roles here. And this guy... Zed Sakal, who was in last week's AFI movie Yankee Doodle Dandy. He's in two in a row, and he actually has more screen time than the more famous actors Lorre and Greenstreet. Mm-hmm. And he's in this one too. Dooley Wilson, we said already, mm-hmm. who is not playing the piano.
Most of those. No kidding.
The dude can sing, but he wasn't playing the piano.
No, he was just mashing his hands on the keys. He wasn't even trying all that hard.
And then Conrad Veidt, we just mentioned him. He ironically was strongly opposed to the Nazis in real life and was happy to portray Strasser as a horrible jerk.
He was an emigre in the 20s, I think, but because he had an accent, as much as he hated the Nazis, he spent most of his Hollywood career portraying Nazis.
But think about that. If you wanted to really stick it to somebody in an artistic way in a movie, then it's almost like, use me to play somebody I hate so I can make them look even worse than, well, they were bad, but I can make them look as bad as I possibly can.
Yeah, and he does. He does a great job.
He's a good villain. Now, we said Michael Curtiz directed this film. He'd been working the business since 1916. And he would work in almost another 20 years after this movie. Beyond Yankee Doodle Dandy and Casablanca, he made The Adventures of Robin Hood, Mildred Pierce, and White Christmas. Nice diversity there. Mm. Journeyman director. And he won the Oscar for this film. We talked already about the writers, the Epstein brothers, and Howard Koch wrote the screenplay. Also, Casey Robinson. I've never heard of him before. Casey Robinson did some major work on the script, but he didn't take any credit for it. He should have. He would have won an award with the other people. And Hal Wallace was the producer. He originally wanted William Wyler to direct.
Yeah,
directed Best Years of Our Lives coming up in a few weeks in the project. We've already done Wuthering Heights. We will do Ben-Hur.
I think there's a notorious story about how he got upstaged when they won Best Picture Oscar.
Wallace, yeah.
Yeah, that the Warner, somebody from Warner.
Jack Warner.
Yeah. Jack Warner, went and accepted. And then they physically stopped him from getting on stage so that they could hog the stage.
Even though Wallace produced this and Yankee Doodle Dandy.
Yeah. And after that, he left Warner. Enough of this.
Crap, We've said Warner plenty in this podcast. I think I said this quite a few podcasts ago. It's a studio that dominates the 40s. They've done the last two movies. They still have Treasure of Sierra Madre. I think they had something else we've already talked about. I don't know if they're big all through the whole
MGM project, had the 30s. MGM had all the big projects in the 30s.
They might have quite a few in the 60s with those musicals as well. Mm-hmm. I don't know. A few other technical people we definitely got to highlight would be Max Steiner. Did the music. 5 AFI Top 100s, including this film. He didn't like the famous As Time Goes By song, though, because it wasn't his recording. He didn't write it.
Yeah, they were going to redo it so that he could just replace it with a song that he wrote, but...
Because he wanted the royalties.
And then Ingrid Bergman, they would have had to reshoot scenes with her to say, the famous line, play as time goes by. Mm-hmm. But she had cut her hair for a different movie, so they couldn't get her back to do retakes. Yep. So they were just stuck with As Time Goes By, and he had to write the whole score around that. Between that and Marseille, those were the two songs that he based the score on.
Marseille is, yeah.
Yeah.
So Arthur, I guess you pronounce it Edison. A couple mm-hmm. of podcasts ago, I called him Edison. I must have just looked it up wrong, the spelling wrong. But he was a cinematographer, and he also photographed All Quiet on the Western Front, Frankenstein, Mutant and the Bounty, and The Maltese Falcon. The guy.
Now we've seen a lot of him, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And the legendary Ori Kelly did the costumes.
Speaking of cinematography, one of my pet peeves with old movies, this movie's totally guilty of it, is every time it's a close-up of Bergman, it is just the gauzy, Vaseline, soft focus, overlit, eye light, just over the top. Every single thing they could do to make her look beautiful, they did, but it also makes her shots look completely inconsistent with everything else that's going on in the scene. Mm-hmm. It's a little frustrating. I didn't like that. It sticks out so much.
Well, they use the shadows and light so well in this film. Generally, but you're right, it makes her look perfect. Mm-hmm. I mentioned the Passions special mm-hmm. a few times already. It's Anne Jackson, I believe, Eli Wallach's wife, mm-hmm. is talking about various movies. And she's talking about some film where a woman's dying. It might be Greta Garbo. And her whole thing, she's funny about it, is like, dying in a key light. So she's lit just perfectly. She's got the key light on her, so she's good there.
Isn't that just a notorious Hollywoodism?
Well, contrast to modern movies where, yeah, a lot of times they look perfect, but a lot of other times when it comes to I have a disease or I'm dying of something, they look worse than they probably otherwise would. I mean, now it's almost the flip side where they make somebody look just awful.
I guess so. I don't know. I'm sure we could, if we thought about it, we could think of a bunch of modern films where somebody's dying of a gunshot wound and still their makeup is perfect.
Well, the gunshot wound death is always about having the constipated face.
Yes.
I wish we had some visuals sometimes with this, and this is right now I could do my gunshot wound from the 30s and 40s thing.
You never touch your chest and look like you're constipated.
Or if you ever got shot in the arm. In Chinatown, we mentioned Chinatown, we did Maltese Falcon a few weeks ago, is guilty of this. When Noah Cross gets shot in the arm towards the movie, he just kind of flinches. Like, he's an old man, got shot in the arm. I'm just not going to be killed from that, but he just kind of flinches like a mosquito bit him on that nose or something.
Owie!
That kind of hurts. Not much. Okay, moving on. All right, bit of a tangent. So let's talk about some influences, because this movie, of course, has a ton, but I'm going to highlight maybe five or six in particular. It was remade as Havana with Robert Redford and Lena Olin, directed by Tootsie director Sidney Pollack, one of Redford's longtime collaborators. And then, Barbed Wire. Yes, that Barbed Wire, the Pam Anderson movie. And Pamela Anderson is in the bogey role.
Oh, that's kind of a neat twist. I never saw Barbed Wire.
You don't need record. To.
Okay.
She is no good at being noble either.
Oh, anyway. She doesn't stick her neck out for nobody?
She sticks something else out for lots of people. A couple of something else's. Obviously, The Usual Suspects, the movie, bases the name of their movie on that great Claude Rains line. And there were two TV series. One was in the 1950s, 1955, ran for 10 episodes. But more hilariously, they tried to make it again in 1983 with David Soul from Starsky and Hutch.
Oh, yeah.
And that lasted a mere 7 episodes. And Scatman Crothers, the
cook Sam, from... Yes, that's right.
Yeah, he played Sam, the cook from Shining and also he's in Cuckoo's Nest, an AFI film, Cuckoo's Nest. Scatman. And of course, I think most people who have watched a modern DVD or even videotape would know the few notes of A Time Goes By is when you see the Warner Brothers logo.
Yeah.
They've had that for several years. And like I said, we already went over the other lists. It is on a ton of them. It's as beloved as any film in the history of the AFI. One thing I will say about that to wrap that whole point up is that whenever I watch those AFI specials, and if Casablanca had any chance of making it, I thought, well, I'm going to guess where it was. And like I said, I guessed it would be number one in The Passions. I didn't think it was going to be on the throws list, but the quotes, I knew there was going to be at least 4 and it would be in 6. It's almost kind of cliche, but the AFI worships this movie.
Because it's such a typical Hollywood film. I can see why the AFI, you know, one thing that I'm finding as we're going through this list is it really does uncritically worship the Hollywood system and reward movies that just play into it with all of the cliches. Like, you know, we talk about Casablanca. Of course it's a great film. It's a really well-made film. And we talk about the influence, but its influences really are just about homages. You can't say that film changed because of Casablanca the way it did after Citizen Kane was made.
Or Birth of a Nation.
Or Birth of a Nation,
even. Or Star Wars.
Yes, yeah. These movies actually change films that were made afterwards. But you can't really say that about Casablanca. It just took all of these components that were already being used and all these techniques that were already being done, and it happened to do them all exceptionally well without pushing the boundaries all that much. And this is why I said at the beginning of the podcast, I wouldn't put this in my top 10. It's not that it's not a great movie. It's a totally great movie. It's just not, I always am going to side in favor of the vanguard. You know, I'm always going to side in the favor of the filmmaker that's pushing the boundaries and doing something new and exciting that's actually going to change film and take it in a new direction that surprises people. I love being surprised. And this movie, as great as it is, didn't really surprise me. It was delightful, but it wasn't really all that challenging as much as I like my films to be, I guess you could say. And the AFI doesn't tend to award challenging movies.
I think it's worthy of being in the top 10 for sure. And again, I was not surprised when I saw either list in 98 and 2007 that it was in the top somewhere. It knocked down a spot by Godfather, which didn't surprise me either. I thought Godfather had a shot at being number one because of the way that even more after 10 years it had become so beloved. The IMDb's top 250 is almost always, for as long as I can remember now, it's been Shawshank and Godfather flip-flopping. Which I don't know. I love Shawshank. Most people do, but why it's number one, I don't know. But Godfather being number two, Casablanca is nowhere near the top of that list for what it's worth. And as I said, The Sight and Sound has never once had it in their top 10. But there are other people we should talk about because you've mentioned them a few times on podcasts. I never, really never have, but I actually looked this up today. I was really curious to know what Rotten Tomatoes, the critics in general, have thought about Casablanca and other films in comparison. So here's a quick little summary. Casablanca gets a 97% on Rotten Tomatoes from the critics, but only 93% from the audiences.
Yeah.
That's very good, but not 100%. Citizen Kane and Godfather, it's two rivals on the two lists. Kane and Godfather got 100% from the critics, while Kane was 90% only from the audiences, and Godfather 97%. So that's the most popular from the audiences. A couple other movies I'll mention are very popular from that era. Gone with the Wind, 96% from the critics, 90% from the audiences. And Wizard of Oz got 99% of critics on its side, but only 83% from audiences.
Wow, that's very interesting.
And I think we know that an awful lot of revered critics, Roger Ebert, we've talked about him so often. On the commentary, he says something like, Citizen Kane is the best movie ever made, but my favorite movie ever made is Casablanca, which I don't know if he's actually been consistent about that with other things he said.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've also heard him say that Citizen Kane is his favorite movie.
And then I think he said it's one of the Ozu films that's his favorite movie, but anyway.
Yeah, there you go.
Another good commentary, by the way. I mentioned that Citizen Kane, his commentary is the best I've ever heard. I stand by that. The one on Casablanca is more casual, conversational, but also a very good one.
And there are critics who have been pretty outspoken about not liking Casablanca, Pauline Kael, notably. She criticizes the same sort of things that I'm criticizing, that she was a little less forgiving than I am. She said it's far from a great film, but it has a special, appealingly schlocky romanticism, were her words. Not very kind. Umberto Eco called it mediocre, and he said that due to the presence of multiple archetypes which allow the power of narrative in its natural state without art intervening to discipline, it is a movie reaching Homeric depths as a phenomenon worthy of awe. You know what?
It is so wordy.
It is so, like, this guy's obviously pretty esoteric.
He could have just said, I kind of liked it. It was all right.
He could be like, I'm too snobby to like this film, I'm afraid.
He could have just said, meh.
Meh. This isn't a film for snobs, I don't think, but it's certainly not as much the people's film as something like Wizard of Oz or even Gone with the Wind. I think it's even more sophisticated than those movies. No? You disagree?
No, I'm just contemplating. I'm thinking about the fact that it's playing on something that was really happening that mattered.
Mm-hmm.
The defining moment maybe of the entire century, as it turned out. No one knew that then.
Yeah,
too.
No, it's true.
The war was still new for America. It had been going on for a while in Europe, but it was still far from over for anybody in Europe or Asia or anywhere else where it was happening. So it's by no means a documentary, but it's kind of playing off of real life more than most AFI movies, any AFI movie did, of all the 123. So many of them are about things that, like Forrest Gump, for example, plays off things that really happened, putting Forrest in places where he never was, which is, of course, funny and clever in many cases. It's not that it doesn't mean anything, but it's almost like, here's Forrest's odyssey through reality, and even though he's not a real person. Titanic is based on a real event. Of course, Rose and Jack weren't on the boat, as far as we know, but the actual event we know did happen, and many other films were based on real things.
But well after the fact.
Right, and this is happening while it's in the moment. We're going to have Apocalypse Now and Deer Hunter back-to-back. Both Vietnam movies, but quite a few years after the Vietnam War was over.
When there was some kind of distance to actually look at it from a bird's eye point.
And how would they have been? Also, war films. This is a war film. We don't see anybody in a tank. We don't see anybody in some plane flying over and dropping bombs on anybody, but it's still a war film. And they had to reference something that was still happening, as we've made that point already. But those 2 months I just mentioned were set way after the fact, and
they when can they already whatever knew, they want to do. They already knew how the war was going to end. When Casablanca was made, for all they knew, the whole world was going to be occupied Germany.
And that ups the stakes. Years. Maybe this movie would have been burned by the Germans many years later.
Yeah.
And also when they made it, as we said off the top, nobody involved, or very few people at least involved, thought they were making a classic. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of the Germans burning the film, there were parts of Europe where they refused to show it because they thought it would rile up the resistance to Nazi occupation.
Angry up the blood.
Yes, yeah.
All right, so this movie has been reviewed by, I think, 17,000 people now.
17,000 is a modest estimation.
In many ways, online, written reviews, and here podcasts.
We throw ours onto the pile for you, dear listener.
We've probably added very little to your experience. If you've seen the movie, you probably have gained very little from us here, but we hope you at least enjoyed yourself. But next week, we get to do something that's going to mean a lot less, but it's still a movie I have loved and have hyped up so many times. To my wife, and that is Billy Wilder's Great Tale of Lust and Insurance Scams, Double Indemnity.
Yes, I've never seen it. I actually know very little about it.
I mentioned this is the only time we saw Bergman on the AFI list. This will, next film, Double Indemnity, will be the only time we see Barbara Stanwyck, who was great. Mm-hmm. What a great actress he was. And the only time we see Ever G. Robinson as well. But our first example of Billy Wilder. He had four films.
Yeah.
So that'll be next week. And leading into that is our coming attractions trivia question. Barbara Stanwyck's character Phyllis is eighth on the evil side of the top 100 heroes and villains list. How many females are in the villainous top 10? And how many females are on the heroes top 10?
Oh, I don't know.
I was trying to find something compelling about this, and that's what came to me. I thought, are there a lot of women on either one of those top 10s?
Mm-hmm.
We'll tell you next week what it was. It won't be hard to find this if you care to. It's very easy to find it.
Yeah, I'm actually really curious now. That's an interesting little point.
So that'll be next week. Double Indemnity.
In the meantime, for more from Ryan and me, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and you can find us on Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. If you'd like to reach us, please email us, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com.
He's looking at you, kid.
And cut.